we are coming off another dazzling East Lansing Summer Solstice Jazz Festival. I hope you had the chance to take this in Friday or Saturday. I had more fun just watching drummer Pepe Espinoza do his thing on the drums with Aguan Co. to close out the show on Saturday night. This guy, and there were probably 20 couples up dancing in front of the stage. Everybody had such a good time. And this drummer is some kind of player. Just watching him incorporate all of his drums and cowbells into the sound of the band and really drive the band. It was just such a visual treat to watch this guy work. Hope you had the chance to enjoy that. It was a good time. It is the first Monday of summer here on Current State. Coming up this hour, we say soccer, everybody else says football. What gives? Professor Stefan Szymanski of the University of Michigan will explain. And today on Current State's Voices of Experience, East Lansing's Pauline Adams, who taught in MSU classrooms for nearly 60 years. She's seen a lot in her 90-some years. She joins me later this hour. We hope you can stay close. The Michigan State University campus here in East Lansing is often described as one of the most beautiful in America. This week, one unique campus flower is drawing particular attention, the so-called corpse flower. Has the stench of a rotting corpse. It is also, I'm told, the largest flower in the world. One of the few in the United States is here at MSU. People are coming from around the region here to see this flower in bloom. They only have a couple of days to enjoy that and the stench. Joining us today on Current State to tell us more about the mysterious corpse flower, Frank Tolusky, professor of plant biology and curator of the Plant Biology Conservatory. Welcome back, Frank.
Thank you.
Along with Peter Carrington, assistant curator. Hi,
Thank
Peter.
You.
What can you tell us about the status of the corpse flower? I know everybody's keeping a real close watch on when this blooms. Has it bloomed?
Not yet. As of this morning, the main what we call the spathe, it's kind of a, think of it as a petal, but it's not a true petal that surrounds the flower, has not peeled away from the spathex.
Okay.
The spathex is the part that actually contains the flowers, the male and female flowers. We're hoping that this will happen shortly, maybe within the next few days. I'm hoping maybe by Wednesday. But it seems to be taking its time. It's very hard to predict exactly when this was open. But for those who are interested in following us, we do have a Facebook page, the W.J. Beale Botanical Garden. You don't have to be a member of Facebook. It is a public page, and we are posting updates up there daily, sometimes hourly, to keep people informed about its status.
And Peter Carrington, this creates quite a stir. Talk to us about that. People come from all over to witness the corpse flower.
It's quite an unusual event, and in any given decade, there are very few flowers from this plant around the world outside of its natural habitat on the island of Sumatra in Indonesia. And so getting a chance to actually lay eyes on one of these things when it's really open, really at anthesis, is really quite a memorable event.
Is it the largest flower in the world?
Well, technically, if you get into the language of it, it's technically the largest unbranched inflorescence in the world. We have this giant thing. And superficially, of course, to any civilian, you could say that looks like a single flower. But there are actually several hundred male flowers and several hundred female flowers in this one structure that looks like a colossal, 6.5 foot tall flower.
And so visually, this sounds pretty dramatic. What color is it,
well,
Frank?
Well, when the spathe opens up, it'll be a maroon-red color, and a lot of people think, correctly so, I think that it resembles that of rotting flesh, because the smell that it'll produce will also be mimicking that wonderful odor.
How many corpse flowers are there in the country?
I don't know exactly how many. I know there's one at the National Botanical Garden in Washington, D.C. Brooklyn Botanical Garden has one. The Franklin Conservatory in Columbus, Ohio. I understand there's two at Selby Botanical Garden in Sarasota, Florida. And one of those may be also getting ready to bloom. I just sent an email to them to confirm that. And if it is, we're going to try to do a pollen exchange so that maybe we can actually cross-pollinate the flowers.
There's some cross, and that would achieve what?
Oh, that would help to produce fertilized seeds, so that we could actually produce plants from seeds that rather through the sexual production of the flower, as opposed to asexual production from having the corm divide down below ground.
Okay. We're talking with Frank Tolewski and Peter Carrington of the MSU Department of Plant Biology. We're talking about the corpse flower, which is just about to bloom. It's renowned for its stench and and for its size. Why are they so rare, Peter?
Well, they never have. I mean, the species actually evolved on the island of Sumatra, and so there really isn't. It was never common, even in its home range. And so the fact that it takes so long, I mean, it's not too hard to get a hold of one of these corms. They could be the size of a peanut or so. But they have to grow up to almost 30 pounds of corm, tuber, in order to be large enough to have the critical mass necessary to flower. So that happens relatively rarely, at least outside of its home range. But like I say, it was never common, even in its home range on Sumatra.
So it's academic interest in this thing that really drives it. It's not a popular appeal?
I think there is a certain amount of popular appeal to it. Again, as you stated before, in terms of being the largest unbracted inflorescence, and the fact that you have this smell that's unique. It's insect pollinated, and that smell attracts things that are attracted to carrion as opposed to honeybees or bees that are attracted to sweet scents. And I think the really important thing for us as curatorial folks here at MSU and at a university that has such a strong plant biology emphasis and program through a number of departments and colleges, that this is an important outreach element, that we can actually grab a person's imagination, grab family imagination, small children and adults as well, about the wonders of the plant kingdom, and to get them curious about plants. And as we move more and more into a virtual environment and video games and urban environments where plants like this are even becoming rarer to exposure, that this is a great opportunity to expose people to the wonder of the plant kingdom.
When was the last time the corpse flower bloomed?
Well, this particular plant bloomed in 2010, but we had had the plant for roughly 20-some years by that point.
And before that? It's unpredictable. The locusts or the cicadas
A matter of clockwork. It's a matter of how long it takes to achieve the critical mass necessary to make a flower. So under excellent conditions, such as our plant has received in the conservatory, we've gotten it to flower here today, but that's only 4 years after the last time it flowered. Mm. It's probably not that often, except under the finest conditions, even in the wild. And so many people take decades before this thing gets large enough to flower.
Do you let members of the public come and witness this plant?
We have the conservatory open just for this event. The public can come during any of the weekdays between 10 o'clock and 2 in the afternoon. If it's still relevant by this weekend, we would offer it hours from 1 to 4 in the afternoon on the weekend days.
And remind us where the Plant Biology Conservatory is, Frank.
The Plant Biology Conservatory is at the corner of Farm Lane and Wilson Roads, and there's a small road drive as you're heading east on Wilson Road, just east of Farm Lane, called Science Drive, and there's an A-frame sign pointing to the corpse flower with the times on it. We suggest that people coming to campus during the work week, park either in the Wharton Center parking ramp, public parking area, or in the public parking lot over by Horticulture near the 4-H Children's Garden off of Bogue Street, and then walk over to there. Because as you know, parking on campus can be quite difficult. After 6 p.m. or certainly on weekends, parking is free. And when this flower does bloom, and we'll put the, as we say, we're following on our Facebook page with the social media. When it does bloom, I'd like to open it up so that people who are working until 5 o'clock have an opportunity to come and see it as well. So the day that we announce that it's actually in bloom, I'm going to open it up till 7 p.m. so that people can actually see it if they can't get out of work until 5.
You know, the day that happens, let us know.
And absolutely.
We'll spread the word.
Yeah.
as well.
I'd like to give a little shout out to Jan Sirens, who's our botanical gardens technician over in plant biology, and she really works wonders with plants. And so it's to her credit that she's gotten this thing to bloom within 4 years of each other. And I think that, we're not sure if it's a horticultural record or not. We're going to be checking with some of our colleagues at other institutions, but to get this thing to bloom in such a short period of time. So blooming in 2000, blooming again in 2014. It's a remarkable feat, and she's to be congratulated.
That requires some particular kind of nutrition then, or what?
Well, she fertilizes it. She waters it. She makes sure that the leaf, when the single leaf comes up in those years when it's not flowering, has plenty of opportunity to photosynthesize and build up that critical mass, as Peter calls it, that photosynthate, the starch, for it to be able to flower.
How close do you have to get to this thing to savor the stench of the corpse flower?
Well, I expect that when it's fully open, you won't have to get all that close to it. It is in a room, more or less, and I don't think there'll be anywhere in the room that you can hide your olfactory senses from this once it gets actually cooking, but that isn't just quite yet.
Do botanists, horticulturalists, take plants from one part of the world and actively try to propagate them? I'm talking about in the wild, not in academic settings, but in the wild, in other parts of the world. Does that happen, Frank?
I guess it depends on your definition of the wild. Certainly in forestry and in horticulture and in agriculture, we do this all the time. We grow pineapples in Hawaii when they're native to South America. We grow coffee in South America when it's native to Africa. We grow citrus in America where it's native to Asia.
What about non-agricultural crops?
Yeah, in terms of non-agricultural, I don't know of too many where we deliberately introduce them into the wild. There's been accidental introductions with invasive species, which cause a different set of problems for us ecologically. So we think of loosestrife or garlic mustard or buckthorn here in Michigan. Unfortunately, those non-native plants are very successful at colonizing and then outcompeting some of our native species. But to do it, we don't really do that much. I think if you go back in time, and certainly Professor Beal's time, when they were interested in reforestation and trying to reestablish forests in Michigan, he was looking at both native and non-native species. He experimented with, for instance, Norway spruce and with Scots pine. But in plantations, we see some of those, but mostly going back to using native species, white pine, red pine, that's native to the state.
We were talking about this before we came on air, but talk to us, Peter, about the redwood story that
there
we
is
got
a,
into.
There is a species called a dawn redwood in the genus Metasequoia that has been known for centuries as fossils. So it was astounding in 1940, a scientist from the Central Forestry Institute of China, Dr. Fan, while walking down a footpath that connected Hubei to Sichuan province, found a very large, unusual-looking conifer next to the road. But because the dawn redwood loses its leaves as though it were a deciduous tree in the winter, it was several years before the tree was fully described, and a couple of years after that before any seeds were actually brought out of China. And the very first batch of seeds came out by diplomatic courier to the U.S. Embassy, which I believe was in Shanghai at that time, and then delivered to Dr. Merrill at the Arnold Arboretum at Harvard. And then he took those seeds and their subsequent seedlings and distributed them to 77 botanical institutions literally around the world. And that's how we come to know that even though its present-day wild distribution was so tiny, it's only two small valleys in southwestern China, that this species is still able to be grown in a wide selection of the available climates on planet Earth today.
Amazing, talking about propagation here. We only knew about this species through fossils previously to that, and it was rediscovered in 1940.
Now, another view to this question is that our role as botanists might be a little different in the future, because as global warming tends to restrict species in places where the climate, they could be reintroduced in other places that are becoming more and more accessible to that. that species. And so we may see more of this as an effort to protect species in the long term.
Interesting. We'll keep an eye on it. Frank Tolusky is a professor of plant biology and curator of the Plant Biology Conservatory, along with Peter Carrington, assistant curator. We're keeping an eye on the corpse flower here at Michigan State University. Frank and Peter, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. Football is played with your hands. Soccer is played with your feet. Here in the U.S., that's something that's been ingrained in American culture, despite any international criticism of its absurdity. However, a recently published paper reveals that the origins of the word soccer aren't American at all. They're actually British. Joining us now is the paper's author, Stefan Szymański. He's a professor of sports management at the University of Michigan. Welcome, Stefan.
Good morning.
First, soccer, football, no matter what you want to call it, yesterday's match between the U.S. and Portugal was just incredible. Cristiano Ronaldo finally shows up during the last possible seconds of the match. What a gut punch. What'd you make of it?
It was a great game, and I think in the end, a great result for the United States, and I think U.S. is almost certainly going to go through the group, which you'd have got good odds on before the competition, so I think great for Team USA.
The World Cup's been filled with so many close games, and it seems lately with each World Cup, the tournament's popularity in the U.S., just continues to grow exponentially. If this keeps up, will we start calling it football pretty soon?
No, I don't think you're going to start calling it football, because you've got another football which you play, which is obviously a far more important sport at the moment. And even if soccer does become really important, I don't think you'll give up. So I think the name soccer is here to stay.
So it's actually British or English. What's the history there?
So basically, the rules of the games that people call football in different countries were mostly written down in the last half of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of different versions of these games. So there's the game that they're playing in Brazil, which was originally called association football. There's a game that looks a little bit like the American version of football called rugby football. There's an Australian game called Australian Rules Football. There's an Irish game called Gaelic Football. So basically, at the end of the 19th century, you've got all these different versions of football kicking around, and you need to distinguish one from another. And in England, where the association football version and the rugby football version were very popular, the names got shortened to rugger on one hand and soccer on the other.
Hmm. And how did the word soccer come to America then?
Well, it came pretty quickly, in fact, because already by the time this was coined, which is in the 1890s, already Walter Camp is doing his stuff and really turning rugby football into what you call football and what most of the rest of the world calls American football. And so and that really took off far more than, and became far more popular than soccer, although soccer was known in association football was being played in the United States. And so when in the first decade of the 20th century there's a big push to try and popularize the game in the United States, people start looking for a name to distinguish it from all the already established version of football, and that's how soccer gets adopted in the U.S.
Okay. What kinds of sources did you look at to track down the origins of the word?
So the origins you can find just by looking up in the Oxford English Dictionary, and you can read history books on the game which tell this story, which is actually reasonably well known. But what I wanted to do was to document the change in the usage of the words. So what I did was I got a student to go through the New York Times and the Times of London for the last 100 years and see how often the words soccer and football appeared in the newspapers each year, to see the changing popularities of the words over time.
Stefan Chmielewski is a professor of sports management at the University of Michigan. Here we're talking about the origins of the word soccer. Are you gradually acclimating, Stefan, to football with an adjective in front of it then? You've got, you know, American football, rugby football, etc.
Well, I was familiar with American versions of these games before I came. I mean, I like all sorts of football. I like baseball as much as I like cricket. What I find fascinating is the way in which each of these games develop their own history and really individuality. And that's if you like sports, I think that makes it all the more exciting.
We have friends in Britain, and we occasionally get into a talk about cricket and baseball, but I still remember a good friend of ours explaining that there is a game in Britain, or there used to be a game in Britain at least, maybe it's still played, called Rounders.
Oh, that's right. And, that's a traditional English game which goes back hundreds of years. And British people used to usually tease Americans with that because it is, to be honest, it's a children's game. And it's if you watch it, you can see it's like a baby version of baseball. And to some extent, it is the origin of the game. But obviously, in the U.S., it turned into something much more serious. But again, baseball was known in England in the 18th century. So the Prince of Wales in the 1750s actually is said to have played a game of baseball inside Buckingham Palace.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it has a long history. And baseball's also mentioned in one of Jane Austen's novels. So, and she never mentioned the United States at all in any of her writings, but she was writing at the beginning of the 19th century. So baseball, again, it's another game that came from England, traditional game from England. But again, when it gets into the hands of Americans, it becomes very different. It's changed according to the culture of the United States. Mm. So just because it has that origin doesn't mean to say it's obviously the same game.
What do you make of the world's preoccupation with the World Cup?
Well, I mean, soccer is the one sport that's really managed to have this kind of global penetration and achieve popularity everywhere. And you know, I think it's a heady mix of the most popular sport and, you know, nationalism, which is a very powerful force. And you have more nations competing in the World Cup, 209 nations in total, than you have members of the United Nations. There's only 192 members of the UN. So it really is, it's the one thing that the whole world does, and you have this four-year festival where everybody comes together and plays the game. So I think it's a wonderful thing. We had boycotts of the Olympics in the 70s and 80s. I'm a little bit worried that we might be moving back into a boycott era in the future with all the corruption scandals surrounding FIFA.
What do you make of the rise in the popularity of soccer in the United States in recent years?
Well, it's been growing. It's been growing quite remarkably, and certainly, again, one of the things that's clear is, again, if you look at the frequency with which soccer is mentioned compared to the word football in the New York Times for the last 100 years, it's gone from about 10% of mentions 100 years ago to about 30% now. And it does seem that its moment is coming. And events with, you know, if the U.S. team does well, we're going to see increasing focus on the game. And I mean, certainly amongst a lot of young kids, you see people who now follow the Spanish teams, you know, Real Madrid and Barcelona, or they follow the English Premier League. And so I think soccer is taking its place alongside the other major American sports as one of the sports that Americans follow. I don't think it'll ever be the biggest, but I think it will be, you know, it can. There's no reason why it can't rank along hockey and basketball as something that, you know, a large fraction of Americans find interesting to watch.
It seems to me the public schools have done an awful lot to popularize soccer as well, just in terms of the number of teams that you find. Slowly, I'm talking over a period of decades here, the number of schools, public schools, that have started soccer teams.
Yeah, well, it's it's a relatively simple game to organize and play, and of course, you know, public schools have limited resources, and the difficulty with a game, the issue here is that soccer has always been a participatory game. It's always been a game that everybody plays, and I mean, it's not just American school kids. I mean, pretty much every kid around the world has played soccer at some point in their lives, and indeed, to play the game, it actually requires a minimal level of skill just to actually actively participate. The rules are very simple to understand. It's a very simple organization. Whereas with the American sports, it's a bit more difficult. I mean, you need quite a lot of training to play a game of baseball, you know, sensibly, and obviously football is highly organized and highly structured. So soccer's more like basketball, like that, where again basketball is a relatively simple structure which pretty much anybody can do. And so in some ways you might predict that in the future it's the sports that will dominate will be soccer and basketball, although there'll always be a place for the other sports.
Who are you a fan of in this World Cup? Who would you like to see win, and is there anybody you'd like to see lose?
I must say I've been really impressed by the way that Chile has played, and I think I'd like to see them do well. I think they're playing a very attractive style of football. I have a soft spot for Belgium as well, and but I suppose in terms of losing, I'm English, and in soccer terms, you know, Germany's always been the big bogeyman for the English. They're always the team that knock us out or beat us on penalties and whatever. So I'm probably would find it most difficult if the Germans won the whole thing. Although, to be honest, they're looking really, really strong. They're a great, great team, so they may well actually do it.
Stefan Chmielewski is a professor of sports management at the University of Michigan. Stefan, thank you for sharing with us the origins of the word soccer.
Okay, very nice to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
El sol ilumina el estadio. España se viste de fiesta.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. We all know Michiganians we feel are extraordinary for their memorable life experiences or their sacrifices, maybe for their success or their service and the insights that they produce. Getting acquainted with extraordinary people is the focus of Current State's ongoing series, Voices of Experience. Pauline Adams traces her life in East Lansing back to 1947. That's when she, her husband, future university president Walter Adams, and their infant son Jim traveled from New York City to Michigan State College. And that's where the native New Yorkers, who met on a blind date, would begin the next chapter in their young lives. Walter Adams would climb through the ranks and become renowned as a university leader, particularly during the riotous late 60s when he served 9 months as president. Pauline Adams would make her own mark. She would spend nearly 60 years teaching in MSU classrooms, a tenure that ended only last year, a life dedicated to education and to family. I recently sat down with Pauline Adams to talk about her life. She first explained that her love affair with teaching began when she was young.
When I was 12 years old, my aunt, who lived in the neighborhood and had a daughter, Phyllis, and she said, Pauline, can you help Phyllis and teach her how to play the piano? Because I had already taken piano lessons for several years. Not that I was a good pianist. I don't want to misrepresent myself.
But you knew more than Phyllis.
But I knew more than Phyllis, and I loved to teach. So I said, sure, I was willing to teach anything. And so I started teaching Phyllis when I was 12. Well, Phyllis lived in an apartment building with an interior courtyard, and some of the neighbors heard her play, practice, and they said, who's your piano teacher? And within a few short years, by the time I was about 16, I had 21 students. So that was my beginning as a teacher, and I didn't let up until this year. And this year, finally, I said, you've got to give in to your body, and you can no longer do it for the sake of your students. And so this, I'm fully retired, although I retired from Michigan State in 22 years ago, in 1992. But then I went on to teach in the lifelong education program until today.
Tell us about that blind date on which you met Walter.
Well, all I remember about it is that my very close girlfriend was dating this guy. And she said he had a very close friend, Walter. And would I be interested to have a double date with him and go out with Walter? I had never met him. And I did. And it clicked. At least it clicked for me, because I really fell for him immediately. I wouldn't say the contrary was true. I mean, I'm not sure where he stood. But I...
Guys are like that, you know.
Well, they may be. But this guy was. In any case. And we dated and got married.
You and he came to Michigan State in 1947. That must have been significant culture shock. Can you talk about the differences between New York and East Lansing that really stuck out?
Well, for me, it was exciting. It took us 2.5 days to travel here. We had a 6-month-old infant, and we came by car. I took an overnight ferry from Buffalo to Detroit, had a cabin on the ferry. The car was on the ferry, and then we got off and drove down here. There was no I-96 or anything like that. And
you took the boat from Buffalo to Detroit? Okay, interesting.
Yeah, so and it took us 2.5 days. And then we drove down Grand River all the way through little towns to East Lansing, and arrived on a Sunday and went directly to the apartment we had been given on Cherry Lane, the new buildings for new faculty. As a matter of fact, all the bricks were not on our building, 801 Cherry Lane, when we arrived. And I did have quite a culture shock, but it wasn't a shock to me. It was an adventure. I can't explain it. I was very excited by everything that I saw and how different it was. And it was fun for me, but a little bit of a challenge, I will say.
What was Michigan State like in 1947? What do you remember from the campus then?
Well, it was a much more an agricultural college. For instance, up on Shore Lane, I think it was, from our apartments, because Cherry Lane started at Shore Lane, there was some barns with cows and animals in it, and I used to wheel my my son past these barns to see them before they moved away, obviously. I watched the erection of Kellogg Center. I used to wheel him over to the construction site. And Walter's office was in Morrill Hall at the time. And I used to take Jim there every day to pick him up at 5 o'clock to come home for dinner. We walked back together.
And we just lost Morrill Hall. Interesting.
I know. Well, we lost the brick apartments. So all the brick apartments on Cherry Lane were, and they just disappeared with these lovely green fields replacing them. And when that happened, I really had a sense that part of my life had been erased. It was a strange feeling, and it's irrational. But I remember I was attending a Board of Trustees meeting when I first heard that they were going to abolish those buildings, just destroy them. And I said something aloud, and a man in front of me, whom I didn't know, in the audience sector of the meeting, turned around and said to me, "Do you remember which building you lived in?" And I said, "Oh, yes, of course, 801 Cherry Lane." And he said, "Would you like a brick from that building?" And I said, "I'd love it." And then I didn't, and he took my name. I didn't hear anything further. So I forgot about it. Several months later, I get a telephone call from a man, and he said, "Do you still want your brick from 801 Cherry Lane?" I said, "Of course." And he came over with the brick from 801 Cherry Lane. So I now have a brick, a sad, sad brick, worn with time and age, sitting on a lovely wooden block in front of my fireplace. Mm. From 801 Cherry Lane.
Our guest is Pauline Adams here on Current State's Voices of Experience on WKAR. You taught here in the infamous Quonset huts, no less. What did you teach, and how were the classes different then than they are now?
I taught a course which most people would remember by the name of American Thought and Language.
I remember it well.
But when I taught it, it wasn't called American Thought and Language. There were two previous names for the department. The two previous names were Written and Spoken English and then Communication Skills. And when they changed that whole syllabus, it was a wonderful, I thought it was a wonderful change for all the professors who taught it as well as for the students who took it, because it was truly a general education course, which the university college was set up to be, an intermingling of different specializations. And it's now called Writing, Rhetoric, and American Culture.
Okay. Right. Your husband, Walter Adams, was a distinguished economics professor and was the president of Michigan State University for 9 months. In 1969, folks will remember that this was a time of a great deal of student protest and unrest. Tell us of your memories of how he handled that period and what you had to do as his spouse to support him during that time.
Well, when I look back upon it now, I'm almost ashamed to say that we sort of led rather independent lives, in the sense that I was still teaching full-time, and I, which involved all that my teaching required, which was almost my full attention, as well as my duties as a housewife. And he was completely involved in what was going on this tempestuous campus at that time. I was always there, but in the background. Mm. I would attend certain functions that he had to go to. And I became involved in the march to the governor's mansion during protesting the Vietnam War. I was involved in that. But in the background, I can honestly say that all his involvement in these various confrontations and crisis situations, I was not personally involved in. And he did a very informative job of writing that one period of his life up in the only memoir he has ever written, even though I implored him to write others when he retired. He would not write. But that one year he did write up in a book called The Test. So I don't know firsthand. I knew some of the students involved in all the protest movements and what was going on, because he'd bring them to the house, and they'd have discussions sometimes around the fireplace, et cetera, about what was going on. And I did get to know some of the leaders in the protest movements, et cetera, who were wonderful people, I will say.
As his wife, I imagine you thought he was a great president, but did you imagine how, after his tenure, he would become so revered as leading MSU through such a difficult time?
What I admired him most for was his ability to dampen the riotous impulse of a lot of the students here, not only here, but throughout the country, and what was happening throughout the country with police involvement and in some cases killings, as you know, that did not happen here. And it was due to Walter and the way he handled it.
How did he handle that?
He handled it by deliberately getting involved personally with the students in their protest. He would be there at every protest. He refused to call the police to attack them, even though the chief of the campus police was always with him, but not in uniform. And he just wouldn't call out the police. And he did realize that you had to be pragmatic as well as dampen emotions in order to survive without serious consequences during this tumultuous times.
He couldn't have agreed with them all the time, I imagine.
He didn't agree with them much of the time, but that wasn't the issue. The issue was not in agreement. The issue was to maintain a certain calm and rationality here on campus when a lot of the country was in flames. And that was his goal. He didn't necessarily achieve, he knew he would never achieve perfection. What I admired him most for was, one, that he was able to achieve that at Michigan State, which many other university presidents throughout the country did not achieve. And secondly, that he knew himself well enough that what he was a teacher. What he was a researcher and writer in his field, that he didn't want the presidency full time. And even when the end of his year in office, he was offered the presidency and offered presidencies of other colleges, of other universities in the country, he always said no. And he did teach one course during the time he was president. Mm. So that to him, and he knew himself well enough, the power and status and money and prestige that goes with the presidency did not attract him that much. And for that, I really admired him.
So both of you were meant to be in the classroom.
I think so. Yeah. Oh, I know so. And my son as well. So, but not my grandsons.
Tell us about your teaching more recently here. You taught evening college here for a period of time. What was that like? And remind us again, when did you retire?
I retired officially from Michigan State in 1992, but I couldn't stand the thought of not teaching. And so I thought I'd ease into retirement by offering a course in the evening college, which I did the year after I retired. And I enjoyed it so much, I wanted to go on. And so I went on for 22 years.
Walter died in 1998. How did your life change after that?
I was alone. For the first time, I was alone. And I want to say, this you may be interested in, that what kept me company was WKAR. When he died, that radio became my companion. I had it on all the time when I was in the house. Alone, it was a human voice, because I listened, I'm ashamed to say, mainly AM, the talk radio. And it was a human voice. It was my...
A connection.
It was a connection. It meant I wasn't alone. Maybe if I had a pet, I would not have listened to WKAR as often, but I didn't have a pet. But I had a lot of friends. I was very busy and involved, and as a result, I manage.
What do you enjoy doing most these days?
My life, of course, has slowed down. Until now, when I fully retired, I always had my lesson, my course preparation, because each year in the evening college when I taught a different course. It was never the same. So I always had to come up with a new course, and that kept me very well occupied. I worked very hard on it. Now, just keeping up with my household obligations, with my bookkeeping, with my social life, I am very closely involved with many friends. That makes my life very full. And reading, of course, which is important to me.
What do you like to read?
Well, I like to read almost everything. One of my mainstays is the New Yorker magazine, which I've been taking since 1945. So I am an old New Yorker reader, because I read it through from almost beginning to end. And if you know the New Yorker, their articles are very long and involved, so that takes a lot of time. I also read the Sunday New York Times, and I don't get the Daily Times because it's just too much. And then I'm reading novels and nonfiction on the side that come up.
Our guest is Pauline Adams here on Current State's Voices of Experience on WKAR. What do you think might be the biggest issue facing Michigan State in the future? And higher education, maybe in general.
I believe strongly in undergraduate education. I myself, being a product of the 20th century and not of the 21st century, am obsolete in a way, because I am not a real part of this electronic world. I know that I could not teach with over the internet. I know that universities throughout the country have gone in that direction, mainly, I think, for money reasons. It's cheaper. And they're reaching a different generation of students who are more electronically inclined. I, however, believe very strongly that undergraduate education, to humanize a lot of our students, and particularly in a period when they're so wedded to electronics, should be a human encounter. I really am concerned about the direction of modern education. Most universities now are into a different attitude towards undergrad. I'm still talking undergraduate education.
You mean beyond the increasing inclusion of online education? More than just the online education.
Yes, I think the way they're hiring their faculty, who is teaching undergraduate work, many of them are not regular faculty. Many are not hired into the regular faculty tenure stream. And it's a different approach, let me just say, which I think de-emphasizes. And it's not Michigan State. It's a trend that's occurring throughout the country. So I don't know. I sound like an old reprobate in a way. But I am concerned about it.
What do you think of the challenges faced by teachers today?
The challenges are enormous in that their profession, particularly at the university level, has been degraded, I think. And the emphasis is on research. I know that many universities offer positions to faculty, promising them less teaching. You won't have to teach. And that's a form of degrading the whole idea of teaching, that you can focus on your research and trying to get grants and working there. Now, I know how important research is to the progress of civilization. I'm fully aware of that, and I respect that. But I don't want to see it to come at the expense of teaching. And a university should be able to combine the two effectively.
Looking back, what do you think matters most in this life?
I think a sense of contentment, of satisfaction, moderation. I don't believe in extremes in any direction. I think they can lead to fateful events that are destructive. I think in old age, the aim should be to find the line where you don't forget the past. You have all those memories, because those memories are what make up your life. But also, you're not crippled by the memories so that you don't live in the present, and so that you're not aware of the future.
Do you wish you'd spent more time doing any particular thing in your life?
I'm selfish enough to say no. I had a great life. I enjoyed it very much, even though it was difficult at times. But when I look back on it, I just say I was so lucky. I was very fortunate that Walter's first job was at Michigan State College. That when he told his classmates at Yale, "I have a job on graduation at to Michigan State College," they said, "Oh, you'll like Ann Arbor." And no one had heard. They had not heard of Michigan State College. But we showed them. By now, everyone knows Michigan State University.
Pauline Adams, all the best. It's been a pleasure to talk with you here on Current State's Voices of Experience.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we catch up on news out of the Great Lakes this past month with our regular contributor, Gary Wilson. Also, we'll learn about the Archangel Ancient Tree Archive, which is a project that's working to propagate old growth trees before they're gone. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of our program is Peter Worf. The producer of Current State is Joe Lindstroth. Thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering and Maurice Steinbach and Nicole Strobel for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us on Current State on WKAR.